Well, good day, everyone, and welcome to Tuesday, the 26th of March, and March is well on its way out of here, thank goodness, although I was glad to see it come. And now we have the advent of maybe a truly spring month. That is, April is just around the corner, and hopefully it'll bring with us some even warmer and sunnier weather. Speaking of the weather, if you've been up and out and about, you know today is not a very good day. It's really kind of misty and yucky outside, cool as well. Not a fun day. But with that thought in mind, let's take a look at some of the temperatures around the Cape and the islands. But before I do that, I will tell you that this is your volunteer reader, Doug Fagan, coming to you today from the studios of the Audible Local Ledger Service here in, again, rainy and drizzly Mashpee, Massachusetts. All right, temperatures around the Cape are always fairly consistent, as they are today. Buzzards Bay and Wareham on the west side of the canal, 44 degrees is a high today and a low of 41. Moving on to the Cape, across the bridge here, Sandwich and Mashpee all and Falmouth all around 44, 45 degrees today is a high, a low of again 41. Barnstable 44, Dennis 45, Hyannis 44 today is a high, Chatham and Brewster and East Ham, all at 45 degrees as a high. And moving up the Cape, 44 degrees at Truro, and 43 is a high out at Provincetown. Again, cloudy and rain mist throughout the day. Water temperature, still not swimmable. 40 degrees in Cape Cod Bay. Wave heights 6 to 10 feet. Wind direction north-northeast at 12 to 25 knots. Moving out to the islands, same kind of circumstances out there. Martha's Vineyard at Oak Bluffs is 46, same at Edgartown, showers today. Over on Nantucket, Nantucket Village will have a high of 45, as will Secancet. Again, cloudy and rainy today. So not the greatest forecast in the world, but let's look forward to see what we have on the next couple days. Oh, my, not good. Although the temperature rises a little bit, we are allegedly not going to see the sun until possibly late Friday afternoon. And then Saturday, we will see a majority of the day being sunshine. But Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday will have temperatures respectively as highs, 53 Wednesday, 50 Thursday, 47 Friday. Rain tomorrow and Thursday. It's going to be milder tomorrow, but showers around in the afternoon. Periods of rain and a thunderstorm on Thursday. Again, a high of 50 degrees and drops a few degrees on Friday to 47. Some brightening in the afternoon with possible sun coming through then. And Saturday, a high of 52 degrees, but it'll be breezy in the morning. Otherwise, there will be some rather bright sunshine. So keep your swimming trunks and your swimming outfits in the closet and the drawers today. Still not swimmable out in Cape Cod Bay or in Nantucket Sound. Now, if you have a wetsuit, it might be a little different, but I'd still suggest you not think about swimming until it gets a little warmer. All right, friends, let's take a look at today's Tuesday, March 26th edition of the Cape Cod Times, starting on page one. Lots of interesting news going on in the country and the world, frankly, these last couple days, so let's see if the paper is able to keep up. This lead article here on page one is accompanied by a picture, and it has to do with the Dennis Planning Board and consolidation of various shelters as a recommendation of a housing group. Under the picture, it says the Dennis Planning Board is set to review on April 1st whether Housing Assistance Corporation's proposal to transform a former health care facility into a family shelter, whether that is exempt from certain zoning restrictions. The nonprofit housing agency wants to use the 57,000-square-foot former skilled nursing home shown in the picture in 2023 to house up to 79 Families in Transition. This article was by Zane Rizak of the Cape Cod Times Stat. And I'll now read you the full article. The Dennis Planning Board will, on Monday, review whether the Housing Assistance Corporation's proposal to transform a former health care facility into a family shelter is, in fact, exempt from certain zoning restrictions. The nonprofit housing agency, which is based in Hyannis, wants to use the 57,000-square-foot former skilled nursing home, South Dennis Health Care, at 1 Love Lane. They want to use that to house up to 79 families, which is quite a bit. According to the Housing Assistance Corporation, the proposal would consolidate the nonprofit's three family shelters in Barnstable, Falmouth, and Bourne, thereby opening space in those buildings for year-round housing. The redevelopment of the South Dennis property is part of the agency's multi-year strategic plan to address housing insecurity across the region, according to the nonprofit itself. The goal is to open up the new South Dennis shelter by the end of this year. It could be a good location for people to get back on their feet and to learn how to do various things to get back into society if they have had a bad turn in their lives, so said town planner Paul Foley during a recent planning board meeting. They are, whoever they are, is going to be teaching them various skills as well. Peter Freeman of Freeman Law Group in Yarmouthport will represent the Housing Assistance Corporation. According to documents filed with the town, Catalyst Architecture and Interiors will serve as the architect group on the project. So what is the Dover Amendment? Well, the Housing Assistance Corporation wants the project in South Dennis to be allowed by right under a state law known as the Dover Amendment. The Dover Amendment, initially adopted in 1950, mandates that a proposed religious and educational land uses be given more favorable treatment than other proposed uses, such as residential, commercial, or industrial. That is, under the local zoning ordinances and bylaws, according to the Massachusetts Interlocal Insurance Association, an interlocal service of the Massachusetts Municipal Association. The use of zoning exemptions offered under the Dover Amendment has also been raised with a pending purchase by Riverview School, a private East Sandwich school for students with disabilities, of the 40-acre Twin Brooks Golf Course on Scudder Avenue in Hyannis. So what actually is the Housing Assistance Corporation? Well, the nonprofit organization has operated on the Cape and Islands since 1974, opening first as a rental voucher agency. Housing Assistance Corporation has a Lower Cape office in Orleans. The agency's goal is to elevate the Cape and Islands economy and community, empower residents of all ages and income levels, and to address the root causes of our housing crisis. Will the Cape Cod Commission review the project? Well, that's a good question. Foley said the town would submit a development of regional impact referral to the Cape Cod Commission now that Dennis has received the application. I don't know if they'll take it or not. We're going to send them a letter to let them know, said Foley at the meeting. The real issue was the fact that the nursing home just kind of left, and it's gone. A Cape Cod Commission spokesman said the commission thinks there is no basis for finding that the development would constitute a mandatory referral as a development of regional impact. So when was this property purchased? Well, Housing Assistance bought the site known as South Dennis Healthcare for $4.3 million, according to a deed recorded with the Barnstable County Registry of Deeds on September 28th of this year. Woburn-based Next Step Healthcare operated the South Dennis Healthcare prior to its sale. The site was formerly owned by One Love Lane South Dennis LLC. So how, if you're interested, do you attend the April 1 Planning Board meeting? The board will hold a public meeting to discuss the proposal at 6:30 p.m. Monday. That's this coming Monday in the Stone Hearing Room at Dennis Town Hall, which is located at 685 on Route 134. The public can attend in person or virtually. Information on how to attend virtually is available on the town website. All right, friends, that's the end of that article about the housing group's consolidation of shelters and moving that to another area, which would house up to 79 families in South Dennis. More to come on that, we're sure. Well, as we all know, housing is a big concern and a topic of interest throughout the Cape. And this next article of local interest on page one references that as well. And the title of this particular article is Barnstable Wants Public for Housing Panel. It's by Heather McCarron of the Cape Cod Times staff. The Barnstable Town Council President, Felicia Penn, will soon be appointing residents in addition to councilors to a new advisory ad hoc committee and other committees looking at housing and various zoning issues in the area. The Barnstable Council voted to create five new advisory ad hoc committees this past Thursday, but not before debating whether Penn should retain the president's traditional power to appoint members to those committees. In the debate, some councillors cited a recent transparency controversy. Two of the committees, one tasked with reviewing strategies for housing creation in the town, and one that will review zoning and the town's use of regulatory agreements, will include seats for residents at large. The remaining three seats will be filled exclusively by members of the town council. These include one panel that will review the town council's rules and town code, another that will look at the purpose, composition, and functionality and effectiveness of the town's more than 40 standing committees, and another committee that will consider policy related to the town acquisitions, disposal, and development of town-owned properties. So what was the controversy? Well, under town council's current rules, the council president is the one who makes appointments to such committees. Councillor Paul Neary proposed suspending that rule and instead giving the job of vetting appointees to the town's appointments committee, which would then make recommendations to the full council for appointments of persons nominated. Mr. Neary pointed as a concern to the recent controversy with the council leadership's efforts to develop new strategic policy related to development. Earlier this month, a rough outline of ideas for the policy that was marked as, quote, confidential, end quote, was distributed to council members along with an anonymous letter accusing Penn and Vice President Craig Tamish of lacking transparency. I know it's been kind of contentious out here in the public, Neary said, noting his motivation for transferring the appointing authority was to quell the lingering tensions within the community. Councillor Matt Levesque was among those who also supported the move, just in the spirit of transparency, he said. But not everyone shared that opinion. Councillor Betty Lutke said the president's appointing authority has never been challenged prior to this moment, and she doesn't think Penn has done anything wrong from his position. I don't believe that there's a trust problem here, she said, so I don't see a need to change the rules at this juncture when she has worked so hard to put these ad hoc committees together. Councillor Charles Bloom joined Lutke in supporting Ms. Penn, saying he has complete faith in her choices and her recommendations. Ultimately, the proposal to transfer the job of selecting committee members did not pass. So leading into the next paragraph is this statement. Residents show most interest in the housing committee. On Thursday, resident Asia Graves highlighted the need for addressing housing needs and to include the public in those discussions. We don't need you to create new committees filled with your friends and allies, she said. Resident Mary Ann Barboza shared the sentiment, emphasizing the need to ensure the housing committee includes a diversity of perspectives, especially people who are struggling, She said she'd like to be one of those voices. I've never wanted to be on any kind of committee, but I'm telling you, I'm getting on this one, Barbosa said, noting she's driven by a comment she overheard recently that, quote, if people can't afford to live on the Cape, they shouldn't live here, end quote. That has spurred Barbosa to seek a position on the committee. While the town has a standing housing committee, Ms. Penn noted it has been inactive for almost a year, and there is work ahead to reorganize it and to find a housing coordinator. In the meantime, she said, the ad hoc committee will look at general housing issues and explore ideas for addressing them. Frankly, the town council needs to be proactive in trying to set some policies and to hear the conversations, she said. We cannot just sit there and wait until they get a housing this and a housing that. It's too important not to discuss. So what will the so-called zoning committee do? Well, the ad hoc committee that will review zoning and the town's use of regulatory agreements, that is, contracts that set conditions for projects in the town, also got a lot of discussion. Some councillors questioned the committee's true purpose, saying it seems to be aimed at revisiting the form-based zoning the last council adopted for Hyannis after more than 2 years of study and work. Levesque said that zoning has rung through the process with 15 amendments to arrive at a plan that's earned the town recognition at the state level. Penn, however, insisted nobody is going to take away the zoning that was passed here. The purpose is for general constructive review, she said. But if the committee does review that zoning, if it's really good, then it will stay the way it is. And if it needs more improvement, then maybe it does, and maybe we'll try to improve it. The zoning-related committee was created by a 7-6 vote. The housing panel got a 10-2 vote with one abstention. The committees will have the choice of holding remote, hybrid, or in-person meetings with public comments period required. They will regularly update the council and give a final report when their work is done. Applications for appointment to the Housing and Zoning Committees will be available on the Town Council webpage and at Town Hall no later than April 19. Okay, again, more committees, more studies, more focus on housing for, in this case, Barnstable and throughout the Cape. Obviously, there'll be more to come on all of those issues. All right, let's move on. Before continuing with the reading of more articles, some on page 1 and next on the Cape and Islands page, page 3, let's kind of move up a look at the lotteries. They are just significant in terms of their jackpots. Unbelievable. Mega Millions has a current jackpot of $1.1 billion. That's billion with a B, friends. Powerball is at $865 million. Unbelievable. All right, let's take a look at the most recent drawing numbers in the various lotteries here in the state. First, looking at the Mega Millions, the most recent drawing was held last Friday, March 22nd, and here are those numbers that were drawn at that time. 3, 8, 31, 35, and 44 with a Powerball of 16. I'll repeat that. 3, 8, 31, 35, 44, Powerball of 16. Lucky me, I had the 16 for a $2 big pay. Next, taking a look at Powerball. That most recent drawing was held yesterday, and here are the numbers that were drawn then. 7, 11, 19, 53, 68, and a Powerball number of 23. I'll repeat those for you. Yesterday's Powerball drawing, 7, 11, 19, 53, 68, and a Powerball of 23. The next drawing for Powerball will be held tomorrow at 11 p.m. Now, other drawings around the state. Yesterday's midday numbers game drawing. Here are those numbers. 8, 0, 1, 3. Again, that's bid day numbers of yesterday, March 25th, 8013. The evening numbers game drawing, here are those numbers, 8049, 8049 for the evening drawing of the numbers game. Mass cash. Yesterday's drawing for mass cash were these numbers, 8, 19, 24, 29, and 31. Again, mass cash yesterday, 8, 19, 24, 29, and 31. So, friends, if you get a chance, get out there and get those $2 tickets for both Powerball and the Mega Millions. The jackpots are just unbelievably large. And your chances of winning are very small. Kind of a contradiction there, don't you think? But, hey, if you don't play, you can't win. So get those tickets and hope for the best. And as I say to all of you who do play, myself included, good luck, players. I hope something of your investment comes to fruition. All right, let's move on to some other articles here on the Tuesday, March 26th edition of the Cape Cod Times. This next article is very focused on an interesting topic, especially for women around the entire country. And that is the Supreme Court is going to hear arguments today and take up the case of the abortion bill. And this article is entitled, Justice is Set to Hear Abortion Pill Case. Tuesday's arguments could open the path for a total ban on abortion. This is by Maureen Grappi of the USA Today Network with a dateline of Washington, D.C. And here, friends, is the article. 2 years after the Supreme Court erased the constitutional right to an abortion, thus creating a patchwork of access across the country, the Supreme Court justices could pave the way to a national ban. In a case they are considering Tuesday about access to the abortion drug mifepristone, that's spelled M-I-F-E-P-R-I-S-T-O-N-E, the court might give legitimacy to a 19th century obscenity law that some abortion opponents promote as a de facto federal abortion ban that just needs enforcing, and it is the so-called Comstock, S-C-O-M-S-T-O-C-K, the Comstock Act. Named for the anti-vice crusader and U.S. postal inspector Anthony Comstock, the long-dormant law prohibits mailing, quote, lewd or lascivious, end quote, material, as well as anything that could be used to cause an abortion. Even if the court decides the case without addressing the 1873 law, which it could easily do, the justices could restrict access to mifepristone in a way that would make it more difficult for millions of women to end a pregnancy in states where abortion is currently legal. The result would be an end run around the court's stated purpose when it overturned Roe versus Wade, that being of leaving the question of abortion to Congress and state legislatures, according to abortion rights advocates. Keeping in place a lower court's decision restricting access to mifepristone, more than 640 state lawmakers wrote in a brief to the court that it would wrest the power to decide abortion access issues back out of the hands of state legislatures. Abortion opponents say it's the Food and Drug Administration that is doing the end run around the Supreme Court's 2022 decision by enabling women to circumvent state abortion bans by allowing unreasonably easy access to mifepristone, that being via the mail. The FDA, that's Food and Drug Administration's, actions, quote, rob from the people important decisions on this vital issue, end quote, the attorneys general of 22 states told the courts. Most abortions use mifepristone. More than 6 in 10 abortions in the United States last year were completed with pills, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. The Supreme Court is deciding whether the FDA improperly relaxed requirements on mifepristone, one of the two drugs used in medication abortions for early pregnancies. The New Orleans-based Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said the FDA should not have allowed mifepristone to be dispensed through the mail, along with various other changes. The Biden administration said the agency's decisions were based on extensive scientific evidence. They said the case marks the first time a court has restricted access to an FDA-approved drug by second-guessing the agency's expert scientific and medical judgments. The anti-abortion groups challenging mifepristone dispute the FDA's conclusion that the changes it allowed are warranted. They also argue that the FDA is violating the ancient Comstock Act. Over the years, courts and Congress narrowed the scope of the 1873 law, and it has not been enforced by the federal government since the 1930s. But the federal judge, appointed by former President Donald Trump, who first heard the mifepristone challenge, said the Comstock Act prohibits the mailing of abortion drugs. While the appeals court did not rely on the Comstock Act in ruling the FDA went too far, anti-abortion advocates have raised the issue in their filings to the Supreme Court. They argue the Justice Department was wrong to say last year that the law's prohibition on mailing abortion drugs applies only to those used for illegal abortions. The department issued that decision to make it clear the U.S. Postal Service could deliver abortion pills, even in states that have banned or restricted abortion access, because they can be used for other purposes, including to manage miscarriages and for exceptions to abortion bans. That interpretation of the law is strongly rejected by 145 Republican members of the House and Senate. FDA blatantly violated the prohibition on mailing chemical abortion drugs by permitting mail-order chemical abortions, those lawmakers wrote in a brief supporting the mifepristone challenge. Former Attorney General Edward Meese III and Attorney Jay Sekulow, who represented Trump during his first impeachment and is now chief counsel at the American Center for Law and Justice, made similar arguments to the court. So shutting down all abortions as a question? In addition to the legal action, the Conservative Heritage Foundation has put together a policy playbook in case Republicans retake the White House. That includes ending mail-order abortions in violation of long-standing federal laws. They are really putting a lot into this because it's a workaround from having to actually pass an abortion ban, which they know they can't do, said David S. Cohen, professor at the Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He considers the Comstock Act the most significant national threat to abortion rights through either a Supreme Court ruling or a second Trump administration. Banning abortion drugs from the mail wouldn't just keep women from directly receiving them, Cohen said. The drugs also could not be shipped to doctors. Neither could medical supplies or instruments needed for surgical abortions, he said. That interpretation could shut down all abortions, he said. Julie Kay, an attorney with the America Civil Liberties Union's Reproductive Freedom Project, said it's possible, though it would be surprising, for the court to signal that this zombie law from the 1880s can be used to ban all abortion without any involvement from Congress. In the Justice Department's briefs to the court, Solicitor General Elizabeth Pregelor reminded the justices that the appeals court decision they are reviewing did not address the Comstock Act. And this court, she added, should not either. All right, there you have it. Tonight, you'll probably hear on the news just what may have been discussed and decided by the Supreme Court justices as they are set to hear about the availability of the abortion pill mifepristone. All right. Stay tuned tonight for a resulting decision on that. I've now jumped over to page 3, the Cape and Islands page of today's March 26th Cape Cod Times, to see if we've got some local articles there, and we do. Among mostly a page filled with advertisements. But let's get to the article. Here it is. Weymouth man receives a pig kidney. This is by David Smith of the Patriot Ledger in the USA Today Network. Here's the article. Massachusetts General Hospital completed the world's first successful transplant of a genetically edited pig kidney into a 62-year-old Weymouth man living with end-stage kidney disease. Surgeons from the Mass General Transplant Center conducted the 4-hour surgery on Saturday, March 16. The patient, Richard Slayman, is recovering and is expected to be discharged soon, according to a hospital spokesman. The procedure marks a major milestone in the quest to provide more readily available organs to patients, the hospital said in a news release. The procedure was carried out under the leadership of Drs. Leonardo Riella, Medical Director for Kidney Transplantation, Tatsuo Kawai, director of the Logareta Center for Clinical Transplant Tolerance, and Nahal Elias, the interim chief of transplant surgery and the surgical director for kidney transplantation. The pig kidney underwent 69 genomic edits prior to the transplant, the hospital said. Mass General Brigham transplant milestones include the world's first successful human organ transplant, which was a kidney, performed at Brigham and Women's Hospital in 1954, and the nation's first penile transplant, which was performed at Mass General in 2016. Mass General Brigham researchers and clinicians are constantly pushing the boundaries of science to transform medicine and solve significant health issues facing our patients in their daily lives, said Dr. Ann Klebanski, president and CEO of Mass General Brigham Hospital. Nearly 7 decades after the first successful kidney transplant, our clinicians have once again demonstrated our commitment to provide innovative treatments and help ease the burden of disease for our patients and for others around the world. So eGenesis, that's small e, capital G-E-N-E-S-I-S, collaborated with the hospital on making the pig kidney safe for humans. The hospital said the pig kidney was provided by eGenesis of Cambridge from a pig donor that was genetically edited to remove harmful pig genes and to add certain human genes to improve its compatibility with humans. Scientists inactivated porcine, that's P-O-R-C-I-N-E, endogenous retroviruses in the pig donor to eliminate any risk of infection in humans. Mass General eGenesis have conducted extensive collaborative research over the past 5 years. That's according to a news release. The findings were published in the journal Nature in 2023. We are grateful for the courageous contribution of the patient and to the advancement of transplantation science, said eGenesis CEO Michael Curtis. This represents a new frontier in medicine and demonstrates the potential of genome engineering to change the lives of millions of patients globally suffering from kidney failure. More than 100,000 people in the United States are waiting for organ transplants, and 17 people die each day waiting for an organ, according to the United Network for Organ Sharing. A kidney is the most common organ needed for transplant, and end-stage kidney disease rates are estimated to increase 29% to 68% in the U.S. by the year 2030, according to information published in the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. So the Weymouth patients is a beacon of hope for others needing transplant. The real hero today is the patient, Mr. Slayman, as the success of this pioneering surgery, once deemed unimaginable, would not have been possible without his courageous and his willingness to embark on a journey into uncharted medical territory, said Dr. Joran Madsen, director of the hospital's transplant center. As the global medicine community celebrates this monumental achievement, Mr. Slayman, the patient, becomes a beacon of hope for countless individuals suffering from end-stage renal disease and thus opens a new frontier in organ transplantation. Slayman has been a transplant center patient for 11 years. He has been living with type 2 diabetes and hypertension, high blood pressure, for many years, and had received a kidney transplant from a dead human donor in December of 2018, which was performed at the hospital after being on dialysis for the previous 7 years. The transplanted kidney showed signs of failure around 5 years later, requiring Slayman to resume regular dialysis in May of 2023, according to the hospital. Since resuming dialysis, he had dialysis vascular access complications, requiring visits to the hospital every 2 weeks for declotting and surgical revisions, which, of course, impacted his quality of life. The complications are a common problem among dialysis patients, the hospital said. I have the highest levels of trust in the doctors, nurses, and clinical staff who have cared for me, Mr. Slayman said in a statement. When my transplanted kidney began failing in 2023, I again trusted my care team at MGH to meet any goals of not just improving my quality of life, but extending it as well. He said his nephrologist, Dr. Winifred Williams, and the transplant center team suggested the pig kidney transplant and laid out the pros and cons of this procedure. I saw it not only as a way to help me, but a way to provide hope for the thousands of people who need a transplant to simply survive, patient Slayman said. The FDA's role in allowing the surgery to proceed. Well, the procedure was performed under a single compassionate use FDA expanded access protocol referred to as which is granted to a single patient or group of patients with serious life-threatening illnesses or conditions to gain access to experimental treatments or trials when no comparable treatment options or therapies exist, the hospital said in its release. Slayman also received infusion of novel immunosuppressant drugs. Riella led the group of Mass General Transplant Center physicians in applying for the approval of the FDA, which was reviewed by the FDA before its approval in late February. 70 years after the first kidney transplant, and 6 decades following the advent of immunosuppressive medications, we stand on the brink of monumental breakthroughs in transplantation, so said Dr. Riella. All right, there you have it. A Weymouth man has received a pig kidney transplant, and hopefully his life, his being Mr. Richard Slayman, will be significantly improved. Hopefully that works for all concerned, especially Mr. Slayman. Well, friends, we're a little past the halfway point in our broadcast today, and those of you who follow us regularly know that this is when we typically turn to our abortion. So let's do that now. We turn to the obituaries. Our first obituary for today is that of Charles Edward Moore, M-O-O-R-E, has a dateline of Orleans. Charles Edward Ed Moore passed away on March 23rd in Cape Cod Hospital. Ed was born in Washington, D.C. on July 10 of 1937. He was a football athlete in both high school and college. His football coach saw in him a special young man and encouraged him to follow a call to the ministry. Ed always wanted to bring people to know Jesus Christ as their personal Savior, and that was his life's mission. He met Mary Prentice at Camp Wabana in Edgewater, Maryland, where they shared common desires. They were married in March of 59 and moved to North Carolina, where Ed attended seminary at Mars Hill College. He became the pastor of numerous churches and pastored all his life, even after retirement. In 1997, he wanted to raise money to help build a church, so he trained and finished the 101st Boston Marathon at age 60. He was the founder of Moore Security and Services on Cape Cod and was known all over the Cape for his generous and caring spirit. Throughout all of his various experiences and other endeavors, Ed never lost focus of the call he felt God gave him. He touched and impacted many lives with the love of God, sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ with anyone he met, both young and old. He's left behind his brother, Robert, of Great Falls, Virginia, his son, Paul, and daughter, Ruth, and various grandchildren and one great-grandchild. A graveside service for Ed will be held Thursday, March 28th at 10 a.m. at Orleans Cemetery, 144 Main Street in Orleans. All right, there you have it, friends. That's the obituary of Charles Edward Moore. Our next obituary, a short one, is that of Deborah Menzies, M-E-N-Z-I-E-S. It has a dateline of Hingham. Deborah Newton Menzies of Hingham passed away suddenly March 10. She was a longtime administrative assistant at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and she finished her working years at Linden Ponds in Hingham. She leaves behind her loving sisters, Marla, Alexa, Jillian. She also leaves her various nieces. The family's wishes to recognize and thank all of Deborah's caregivers and the entire staff at Windsor Skilled Nursing Facility of South Yarmouth is obvious. In celebration of Deborah's life and love of animals, donations in her name may be kindly made to the MSPCA or Mass Audubon Society. Deborah will be laid to rest at Hingham Cemetery. And that's all we have on that particular obituary of Deborah Menzies of Hingham. Now, returning back to page one, we have an article about Donald Trump and his ongoing legal issues. This article is entitled, New York Judge Rules Trump Must Post $175 million to Shield His Assets. This is a USA Today article, and here it is. Former President Donald Trump got a legal lifeline Monday, an important day for his political and financial future. An appeals court ruled that Trump and his co-defendants, that being his children, need to post only a $175 million bond or deposit as they appeal their civil real estate fraud trial loss, and they have 10 additional days to do so. Trump had been on the hook initially to post a $454 million bond by yesterday, Monday, and this new amount is less than half of that original amount. But his lawyers failed to convince a different judge that he should dismiss a criminal trial on hush money payments to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Jury selection in that case will begin April 15th. The New York judge, Juan Merchan, said on Monday. So with jury selection beginning, the trial begins. The presumptive Republican presidential nominee is facing 34 felony counts of falsifying New York business records in that trial. It was supposed to begin this Monday, but state prosecutors consented to a delay after federal prosecutors sent Trump more than 100,000 pages of documents this month that may be relevant to the case. Trump faces three other criminal cases with no firm trial date, a federal case and a state case from Georgia over whether the former president illegally attempted to steal the 2020 presidential election, and a federal case alleging he mishandled classified documents. Trump has pleaded not guilty, of course, in all his criminal cases. For the civil judgments, Trump had been scrambling to come up with the cash before New York Attorney General Letitia James could start going after his assets. Trump's legal team said in a filing that 30 insurance companies had refused to take real estate as collateral and that obtaining the real estate appeal bond was a practical impossibility. He simultaneously faced an $83.3 million defamation trial loss to advice columnist E. Jean Carroll. In the Carroll case, Trump posted a bond of nearly $92 million shortly before she could have started collecting. The former president has filed appeals in both cases and was thus required to post the bond as an ability to go forward in the appeals cases. If Trump can't come up with the $175 million bond or deposit within 10 days, Letitia James can then start the collection process. That would mean liquidating bank accounts, taking his assets, just not in New York, but any place in the United States, said Mitchell Epner, a longtime New York litigator. We will abide by the decision of the appellate division and post either a bond, equivalent securities, or cash, Trump posted on social media on Monday. One possible source of funds, a deal that took Trump's Truth Social platform and its parent company public. Investors on Friday approved a merger between Trump's media and technology company and Digital World Acquisition Corp. Trump's stake is valued at more than $3 billion, but a prior agreement bars him from selling his shares or borrowing cash against them for 6 months. Moreover, the former president is significantly trailing President Biden in campaign fundraising. Biden raised $21.3 million in February, nearly double what Trump raised the same month, which was $10.9 million. That's according to filings with the Federal Election Commission. Not only that, Biden's campaign has $71 million cash on hand compared to Trump's campaign, which falls behind significantly at $33.5 million. All right, friends, that's an article dealing with another of Trump's dilemmas in court. All right, let's move on, friends. Our next article here is, again, on the Cape and Islands page, and it's entitled For the Community, a remake of Provincetown, a sports field set for a vote. This is by Eric Williams of the Cape Cod Times staff. Here's the article, friends. An $11.7 million plan to redevelop MOTTA, that's M-O-T-T-A, MOTTA Field in Provincetown, will step into the batter's box at Provincetown's annual town meeting on April 1st. According to the town, the main design elements of the plan include a 400-meter, that's one oval, track, regulation soccer and little league fields, a skate park, shuffleboard and bocce ball courts, outdoor exercise equipment, pickleball and tennis courts, and a community plaza for gatherings. A park support building would house a concession stand and public restrooms. Voters at town meeting will be asked to consider approving funding for the project. According to the town, quote, to fund this project, voters will need to approve a $11.7 million debt exclusion override, which would add approximately $181 per year over 15 years to the median property tax bill. The town has applied for and expects to receive other grants to offset some of the cost. If approved, the appropriation would be contingent on a Proposition 2.5 debt exclusion vote at the 2024 annual town meeting on May 14. Special town meeting voters approved the appropriation of $250,000 to fund design, development, and construction documents for the model field redevelopment plan in October of last year. The field is named in honor of Corporal Manuel V. Mata of Provincetown, who was killed in action in Korea in 1950 during the Korean War. Mata was then 18 years old at the time of his death. Provincetown's current recreation director, Brandon Mata, said Manuel Mata was his father's uncle. So what are the goals of the Mata Field Redevelopment Project? Regarding the redevelopment plans, Brandon Mata said the improvements would help make the field accessible to everyone, noting that the current layout presents accessibility challenges, including a steep grade in places for folks who want to use the field. He added that the redeveloped field would allow more multi-generational programming for residents. Mata noted that the redevelopment plan came about after significant public input over a period of about 9 months. The community came together and helped plan this, he said. Jerry Goyette, superintendent of the Provincetown Public School System, said a redeveloped Mata Field would allow the school system to offer additional sports opportunities for students as well. It's for the community and for the kids, he said. So what is a town meeting? Well, most of us here on the Cape know that a town meeting is both an event and an entity, according to the Secretary of the Commonwealth's website. As an event, it is a gathering of a town's eligible voters and is referred to as the town meeting. As an entity, it is the legislative body for towns in Massachusetts and is referred to simply as, quote, town meeting, end quote. 13 of the 15 Cape Cod towns, including Provincetown, have open town meetings, meaning all voters who live in that town may vote on all matters. Falmouth, though, has a representative town meeting where all voters elect town meeting members who then vote on all town meeting matters. The town of Barnstable is governed by an elected town council rather than by a town meeting. So when and where will this Provincetown meeting be held? Provincetown meeting is scheduled for 6 p.m. on Monday, April 1st, in the Town Hall Auditorium at 260 Commercial Street. Where can I find the warrant? Well, if you're interested for warrant information, go to provincetown-ma.gov and seek the town meeting option. All right, there you have it, friends. The proposal to redevelop and remake the Mata Sports Field in Provincetown. All right, that's the end of that article. Now we move to the lighter side of things and the Ask Carolyn column, where people out in the general public write into Carolyn seeking her advice. This article is entitled, Wife Wants to Cut Off Contact with Negative Sister-in-Law. And she writes to Carolyn, Dear Carolyn, my wife, Elise, is in remission from breast cancer and is doing well. I'm so very grateful. She's made a vow to stop wasting time on negative influences. I can see your point, but the problem is this includes my sister. I'll admit my sister is self-centered, bends the truth, that is, she lies, and loves stirring up drama and splashing it all over social media. For example, after my wife Elise was diagnosed, my sister posted how she'd had a premonition that Elise had cancer and begged her to go get it checked. But she did not. None of that ever happened. Another made-up story. But that doesn't mean she's a terrible person. While my wife Elise was sick, she sent food over regularly, checked in daily, and helped with the yard work when I was overwhelmed. I don't think she deserves to be cut out, but Elise sees her as causing constant grief. I've asked Elise to talk to my sister, but she said we've both tried this, and it made the drama even worse. Elise promises she will be cordial to my sister when they meet and says I can see her whenever I want, but plans to avoid her and unfriend and block her on all social media. This will cause unbelievable turmoil, I sense. I'm trying to be sensitive to what my wife has been through, but I think she's going too far. Isn't she? Signed, Anonymous. Here's Carolyn's response. Dear Anonymous, you asked Elise to reconsider, and she said no. You don't have to agree with her to respect her right to do this. And yes, saying, quote, thanks for the food and yard work, end quote, then blocking her is less than ideal, but your sister's disregard for the truth and privacy is even worse. Elise has already compromised by agreeing to be cordial when their paths cross. That's the gig when half a couple opts out of someone. Plus, you technically incurred whatever indebtedness you feel toward your sister. You can't hold your wife to it. The one accommodation I'd add is for Elise to mute versus unfriend your sister. No need to touch off any unbelievable turmoil. About that, flipping out is your sister's problem, not Elise's. Plus, you're citing the threat of turmoil as a reason for Elise to reconsider. But it serves even better as a cause for Elise to distance herself. Don't cave to a tantrum unless you want more tantrums. If the turmoil happens despite Elise's discreet distancing efforts, then it'll be your problem, only to the extent that you would agree to make it yours. You're also at liberty to say to your sister, Elise is giving herself the space she needs, and I totally support her. Then to any other blowback, say, this is not my business, so I'm out, and prove it by staying out. All right, that's pretty interesting, but probably more common than we would imagine, and I'd have to say in this case, probably pretty good advice from Carolyn. Our final article today is kind of interesting. It says, Feds raid properties owned by hip-hop mogul Diddy Combs, has a dateline of Los Angeles. Here it is. U.S. Department of Homeland Security agents have opened an investigation of hip-hop star Sean Diddy Combs, searching his properties in both Los Angeles and Miami, agency officials said on Monday. The inquiry was led by Homeland Security investigation agents in New York, where a lawsuit was filed against Combs by a former girlfriend in federal court in November, accusing him of engaging in sex trafficking. Combs, age 54, has said that he is innocent and that his accusers were seeking, quote, a quick payday, end quote. His New York-based lawyer, Ben Braffman, did not immediately respond to Reuters' request for comment. Television stations in Los Angeles carried aerial video footage showing HSI agents and other law enforcement authorities raiding Combs' lavish estate in the city's upscale Holmby Hills neighborhood. Los Angeles City News Service reported several people were detained outside the home, but it was unclear whether any arrests were made. Local news outlets reported that federal authorities also executed a search warrant at the rap mogul's Miami area home. Reuters footage showed officers going in and out of his property on Miami Beach's Star Island, with agents seen carrying a box of material from the home. Combs' whereabouts during the raids were unknown. HSI spokesman, responding to a Reuters query, said earlier today Homeland Security Investigations, that's HSI, New York, executed law enforcement actions as part of an ongoing investigation with assistance from HSI Los Angeles, HSI Miami, and our local law enforcement partners. HSI has broad jurisdiction to investigate the illegal movement of people, goods, money, technology, and contraband into and out of and throughout the United States, including sex trafficking. R&B vocalist Cassandra Ventura sued Combs in federal court in Manhattan in mid-November, accusing him of subjecting her to physical abuse, sexual slavery, and rape during a 10-year professional and romantic relationship. One of the central allegations of Ventura's suit was that Combs forced her to engage in sex acts with male prostitutes he hired while he watched and filmed the encounters. The lawsuit cited violations of sex trafficking and human trafficking statutes under federal law, New York and California laws. Ventura and Combs, who has used such monikers as P. Daddy, Puff Daddy, and Diddy, announced the next day they had settled the case under confidential terms. So, looks like Sean Diddy Combs is in potential difficulty after these raids by Homeland Security agents in both his Miami and Los Angeles homes. All right, friends, that brings us to the conclusion of today's readings of the Tuesday, March 26th edition of the Cape Cod Times. This is Doug Fagan, your volunteer reader, thanking you for the privilege of your time, and I have enjoyed reading to you today and will look forward to reading for you next week, next Tuesday as well. So with that in mind, I bid you farewell from the studios of the Audible Local Ledger here in Mashpee, Massachusetts. Have a happy and healthy day and a happy and healthy week. So long.